How alarming and charming it is to be a farming. We finally have some spring wind weather. Good morning, Glenn Andreessen, here beside you now. Welcome to the Dirt Bag. With me is my guest, as usual, Jim Gilbert of One Green World Nursery. Full disclosure, One Green World is an underwriter of this program.
And proud to be so. Hi, Glenn.
Jim, you made it.
Yep.
And boy, he was loaded with not five, but six plants that will be available for the as thank you gifts for a $60 pledge. But we'll bring Justin and I think Andrew's going to be joining on that side of the booth in a few moments to talk about the plants. And we'll go from there. But first, on the phone, hopefully, is John Betts. John?
Hi, Glenn.
Yes, John is there. Very good. Way to go, Carlos. John is the producer of Queen of the Sun, the film that has now gone nationwide.
Yeah, thank you very much. And we had the pleasure of being on Dirtbag last fall before the release in Portland.
That was the debut there.
Yes, and it went so well. And thank you so much to Portland. The city, the Office of Sustainability, got behind the release of Queen of the Sun here, and Mayor Sam Adams introduced the film on our opening night, and it was just an incredible show of support for the honeybees and for the power of grassroots, in a city like Portland. It's just overwhelming the support that we found in this city for the film.
That's great.
And it's really allowed us to catapult the film out into the rest of the country and the world.
I talked to Taggart, who's the director, a couple days ago, and he was in Washington, D.C. then, and he mentioned that he was showing it to, what was it, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Department there?
Yeah, at their National Conservation Training Center in Shepherdstown, and they did an hour-long interview that's simulcasted or broadcasted to a lot of the satellite fish and wildlife areas around the country, and they're also doing a big screening there. So that was a huge honor for us.
Yeah. He mentioned, too, that it will open in, Los Angeles and Chicago?
Upcoming for us is very exciting. So since Portland, Portland really, really helped us send sort of a message to art house theaters around the country that there's a huge audience for issues of such great importance like the decline of the bees, and that people really, really care. In Portland, we ran for 7 weeks at the Hollywood Theater, which was just phenomenal for us, and just one of the best runs they had last year of any film. And so we were able to talk to art house theaters all over the country and say, please book us. We will bring in grassroots groups. We'll contact these groups and bring in the support, and you'll see results, and the community will see results. And it's just been so much fun to book all these theaters and to create events where, audiences that normally go to a theater and leave a movie and sort of with that feeling of wanting to do a lot but not knowing where to go, we've been able to really flip that around and provide tabling for groups where when audiences leave, they can suddenly have something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been an incredible thing. So we opened in Chicago a week or two ago. We were opening in the Bay Area the last week of March, which was a great opening. We've opened Seattle, and then we came back to Portland for an encore run on Earth Day, and that was incredible as well. And in fact, multiple locations around Oregon.
Is it still being shown in Portland?
It wrapped up the run probably about a week ago. So unfortunately, you can't see it in the theater anymore in Oregon. But if, check our website, queenofthesun.com, for screenings. And I don't know of any coming up in Oregon because we did so many on Earth Day. but I think Eugene may be continuing to run it a little bit. You could check and see. And then bring it back for community screenings. We're opening the floodgates for people to show this film in their homes and in their organizations very soon. So,
and in 20 seconds, you've partnered with a couple of groups.
Yeah. So in anticipation of New York and LA, which are huge openings for us, June 10 and June 17th, we're also partnering with Pesticide Action Network and Your Garden Show. Pesticide Action Network has a petition, which you can find on our website under the policy change section and take action. And you can petition the EPA to ban clothianidin, which is a pesticide that's really doing incredible harm to bees. And similarly, your garden show has partnered with us for a great project that they're working with called the Great Sunflower Project, where you can go out and count bees in your area, whether you're in Portland, whether you're in a rural area, wherever you are, and they crowdsource that data, which means you submit that data to an online laboratory, and scientists at the University of San Francisco will be able to tabulate that and use that for valuable reports to create policy change around bees. So it's incredible opportunities, yeah. And those are both being linked in.
Well, John, thank you very much. We're in the midst of our membership drive here, and we appreciate you letting us know where the Queen of the Sun is and where people can plug into that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Glenn.
You're welcome.
But, Jim, I see we have some wonderful plants right here. Tell us quickly.
Okay, in 30 seconds or less here. Well, among these are some really, really special ones that I thoroughly love myself. And I'll start with the olive, Arbequina olive. We have one of those self-fertile olive that you can grow right here in Portland.
Okay, Jim, tell us just briefly what they are this break, okay. And then we'll come back and give some explanation
okay.
later on.
All right, great. Well, start with the olive, an Arbequina olive. We actually do have two pineapple guavas.
Okay.
We have one hardy banana and a star jasmine, and a Negroni fig.
Huh. All right, make your decision now.
That's right. You get on that bandwagon right away, and they'll be gone by the time we get back.
That's right. Yeah, we'll be back in 10 or 15 minutes and tell you where we are on that. So thank you for that, Justin. Jim, what's going on in town? You got any events to inform us about?
You know, I have to say that I'm relieved a little bit that I don't have a lot going on anymore.
Okay.
Would you believe this is actually May?
Yes.
I mean, it's this morning didn't feel like May, but it is May, and garden show season is winding down.
So planting season is here.
Planting season is here, and what's the good thing about the cool weather is that you can still plant stuff. You know, like we're not having any heat stress at all. So fruit trees, I mean, all that sort of thing. I usually figure we want to get them in the ground by middle of April. We're still trucking away with that.
Well, I was reading in the American Bee Journal this morning that there is some speculation that this could be a good honey year because there's lots of moisture in the ground, and plants that need that moisture will be able to bloom now that sometimes don't. And so maybe all is not lost as far as honey production.
Well, that would
be good.
Very
slow. I rent out 10 of my honeybee colonies to a blueberry farm, and I've done this 14 years, and I moved them in on the 8th, or 7th, Saturday. And that was the latest that I've ever moved them in. And that's indicative because I don't want to move them in unless the blueberries are blooming.
Yes.
And it's been as early as April 1st. This time, May 7th. Last year it was April 18th, and it was a wet spring last year too. So
there are mornings when I just don't want to talk about the weather.
Okay, this is one of them maybe.
But there's a lot of blooming plants out there, and that's fun. You know, we take whatever we get in the way of this weather, and we're out at the nursery. We're just planting all sorts of stuff right now, getting in the ground. So.
Well, speaking of planting, our plant of the month this month is tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Jim's handled the last two fruiting ones. We talked about figs and we talked about kiwi. And now we'll move to a vegetable because this really is the month, and it could be the time to plant tomatoes. We look at the weather forecast and not really any cold weather coming. And I've seen a few seedling tomatoes coming out of the ground for volunteers from last year's patch, and that's a sign for me to say, okay, if nature is going to grow tomatoes, I can put my tomatoes out. But I haven't planted any in the ground, but I'll talk about that just a bit. If you have a gardening question, we'll have the phones open after the next commercial break or the membership break. And that number is 503-231-8187. That's not the pledge number. Okay, tomatoes, briefly here, with our pledge drive, we have two kind of types of tomatoes that we might talk about here, determinate and indeterminate. Determinate ones get only a certain size, and then they put out a flush of of blooms, and that's about it. There will be a few more through the year, but you get a pretty good crop all at once, and that's great for if you're making salsa or canning or paste or whatnot. And then we have the indeterminates, which generally include the cherry tomatoes and some of the larger sandwich size or beefsteaks, and many of the heirlooms, too, are indeterminates. And they'll just keep growing as long as the weather conditions will allow it. It's not unusual at all to have tomatoes into October, and if you have indeterminates, they'll keep going. One of my favorite varieties, although I can't get it, I haven't been able to find it anymore, is one that was bred at Oregon State called Early Cascade. And it's an indeterminate variety of tomatoes, which is great. And they come early and they'll come late or they'll stay late. They're one of my favorites.
A welcome guest.
Yeah. Yes, good point. And but other, of course, cherry tomatoes, my favorite is Sun Gold, which is a hybrid variety, not a genetically modified ones. I would never recommend those. But these are just hybrids that have, you know, they've been hybridizing plants for, I don't know, how many thousands of years? Several.
Yes.
Probably.
Right.
And it was sweet. And this year might be a good time to diversify your tomatoes and plant more of the cool season crop, cool season ones that are bred for cool seasons, Oregon Spring, Willamette. Although I must say they're not amongst my favorite tasting varieties, but also cherry tomatoes. Cherry tomatoes will always produce here in Western Oregon. It's not ideal tomato growing weather we have here. Just don't have the warm nights for that. But still, we can get a good tomato ripen. Now, how I plant tomatoes is, I don't go for any of the laying them down on their sides. The idea, have you heard of this, Jim?
No.
Yeah, you plant the plant, take it out of its container, and lay the trunk down parallel with the soil underground. So you're putting on its side and then bending up the stalk so it comes out of the ground. So the idea being that you're exposing more of that the stem of the tomato to the warm soil along the surface. I never do any of that stuff. That just takes more time. And I just tend to wait longer in May for the soil to warm up. So I don't do any of that. There's also the this notion of planting these, this is crazy, tomatoes upside down in pots. But I'll just tell you what I do here in just have a few more minutes before we get back to our membership. Less than a minute. I'll dig a hole with my post hole digger. I don't turn up the whole soil. I'll put in, mixing into that soil, I'll mix some compost, some sort of calcium, whether that's eggshells or oyster shell flour, and that helps to, for one, get calcium into the soil. And one of the symptoms of what we call blossom end rot on tomatoes is a lack of calcium in the soil. Jim, tell us a little bit about these plants that are still available. We understand the fig is gone.
Okay. Well, we talked about the awl. We started talking about that. This is a beautiful, self-fertile, evergreen, small tree that has flowers on it right now, which means you could get olives this year.
Uh-huh.
Right here in Portland, Oregon, or in the surrounding area. The pineapple guava is an incredibly beautiful, evergreen shrub that has not only delicious fruit, but delicious flowers. You can eat the flower petals, and they're striking pink and red with red, bright red centers. Really an amazing plant, native to the mountains of Brazil and very hardy here, perfectly adapted to our area. The star jasmine, which everybody knows jasmines. Well, star jasmine is hardy, a hardy jasmine that you can grow right here with incredibly fragrant flowers, beautiful flowers all over the plant, and it blooms all summer. And then the hardy banana is something you can really wow your neighbors or friends with. Plant that in your yard, and you'll have a banana up to 12 feet tall right here in Oregon. This is not the South Seas. This is not Guam. This is Oregon, and you can use the banana leaves for cooking. Unfortunately, it doesn't have edible fruit, but you can go get some of those good organic bananas and sit underneath it and eat your bananas underneath your own banana tree.
Not only edible, well, except for the banana, but they're beautiful plants.
Yes.
You know, nothing says that edible plants can't be a wonderful form addition to your garden.
Absolutely. I mean, that's something that's we need to emphasize, is that you're not sacrificing beauty when you plant something that you can eat.
That's right. Okay, so continuing on with the tomatoes then, planting. Just to recap a little bit, I don't rototill up the whole bed. I don't dig up the whole bed. All I'm doing is preparing a hole to plant the tomato. Longtime listeners will know I really resist disturbing the soil if you don't have to. And so with this method here, you don't. And so with the choose where I'm going to plant the plant, if I've got leaves on that bed, I'll just remove the leaves for that hole. If I have got a cover crop going, I'll cut the cover crop down and still prepare that hole. And then dig some out with my post-hole digger and add compost, a calcium source that I started talking about, and some fertilizer. Organic fertilizer, balanced 5-5-5 would be adequate. Mix that up, plant the tomato, mulch it, done. Well, I have to put some stakes around it. The determinant varieties of tomatoes don't get nearly as tall, but still you'll probably want to put a cage around it of some sort to keep the plant off the ground and hence the fruit off the ground to keep them cleaner and the slugs away from them too. I do not prune it. Some people will say, yeah, you can prune off the suckers, and it probably will increase airflow if that's a problem. Blight tends to be or can be a problem in the fall, but that's mostly a function of the weather. If the weather turns, we have a few days of rain and it still remains warm, the fungal spores are able to reproduce. That's perfect conditions for them. And really no amount of pruning is going to help that. So I just save my time and do something else. Also, sometimes it's recommended that you sever some of the roots in late August to trick the plant into thinking that it's coming to an end and they'll put out more fruit. I don't do that either. I like my plants to grow as long as we can. Sometimes I'll have fruit even into November. So if I kill the plant early or sever it, not going to work so well. So that's my plant of the month, tomatoes. If you have any questions on tomatoes or any other gardening question, give us a call, 503-231-8187. We'll have a garden stumper quiz coming up. Let's see. Maybe we should do that now. Carlos, can you? He's on the phone there. We don't really have to play our garden stumper theme, but let's hit it. Hit the garden stumper theme here if we can. Carlos is filling in great for Kurt here today, and making things happen. Okay, today's garden stumper quiz can be simple, but you have to think about it. I think Jim's thinking about it even. Here it is. What is the first fruit to ripen in Oregon in the spring? First fruit to ripen in Oregon in the spring. All right, if you know the answer to that, give us a call, 232-8818. And we have a caller on the line. Shane, Sean.
That's all right. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Hey, listen, I had a question. Have you guys ever, or tell me what you think about, I was just recently, just happened to read in one of Elliot Coleman's books about four-season gardening, one of the ways he prefers to grow tomatoes is actually on a trellis, where he plants them 15 inches apart on a trellis that's about 8 feet long, and ties a string from, of course, top of the trellis to down the ground. And he keeps each tomato plant to one main stem and lets them grow up to a height of about, however tall they want to get up each string, and doesn't pull the leaves off and so forth. And he finds that they not only grow great, but they also keep the aeration there, and you also don't have to worry about a lot of tomatoes that, say, grow on the ground and drop their fruit. And then the other aspect of it is that you can drape the trellis with plastic in the fall and get tomatoes a lot later into the season.
Well, that sounds doable. It sounds like more work than I'd like to do. In fact, maybe I should just continue on a little bit what I do with my tomatoes, and my tomatoes get 6 or 7 or 8 feet tall,
yeah,
too, as I have made cages out of concrete reinforcing wire. This is pretty stout wire that have 6 inch squares, roughly.
Right.
And in a cylinder, maybe 20 to 20 inches in diameter, maybe 24 inches in diameter, and just stick that around it. And then the only thing that I do is make sure that the branches stay inside the cage.
Right.
And they just grow up inside there. Because I think it would be rather time-consuming to be tying branches up
all the time. Yeah, he just says you just keep tying the stem. Just keep tying it as it goes up, and
yeah,
the friction, the weight of it will hold it to the string. It just sounds intriguing. The main thing is I like the cloche idea.
Yeah,
really allows you to do that.
And what I do with mine, if it's going to rain, is that I'll just put a piece of plywood or something over the top of these concrete reinforcing wires. I mean, they can hold that.
Right.
And keep the rain off, too. Or you could put a, plastic or whatever type of cloche you wanted. I guess glass wouldn't be the best.
Yeah, I have a couple that I use that same reinforcing where I've made kind of a loop. It's a much better so-called tomato cage that I bend the end of the wires around to hook it together. It ends up being kind of oval, so you can reach in. But just a real quick great idea, too, just for anybody out there, is there's some older Asian folks close by that have their own community garden. And actually a very cool, simple idea they have is you take one of those metal stakes, drive it into the ground, and then they take just one piece of that same kind of wire and just interweave it onto the post so it's like a sail.
Hmm.
And so you just initially grow the tomato up the post, and then it just grows up through the wire up on top. So it gets the light on both sides, and you can pick from either side. And it's actually a great idea. So it's almost like a spalier in a way.
Yeah. Well, that sounds, everybody's got their way to do it. There's a lot of right ways.
Right, right.
I suppose there's some wrong ways.
Well, anyway, thanks a lot.
Oh,
I appreciate
bet.
It.
You bet. Thanks for the comment.
It seems like that plastic idea is a nice one, because especially a year like this one.
Yeah.
Boy, we could use some extra heat.
Yeah, heat and the spores for the blight are spread by rain, mostly. We might think about it that way. And so anything to do to keep them off of there is a good thing. Okay, I don't know that we have any callers yet for the answer to the question here. No callers. He says, what is the first fruit to ripen in Oregon in the spring? There's nothing fancy about this. Think farmers markets, even. Mm-hmm. Jim's got an idea, I think.
You didn't tell me this number beforehand.
No,
so
we had less communication this time. All right, well, what's happening in the orchards? What should we be doing in our orchards?
Well, if the plants are in the ground, they're starting to grow, hopefully. I mean, I actually have had people come to me and say they're kind of worried about their plants because they don't see a lot of growth. But because it's been so cool, there isn't yet a lot. And some, like figs, for example, which are just generally late to start, they're not out there yet. So I tell people, I try to calm them down and reassure them that they're still, things are okay. And if you really have concerns and wonder what's going on, do a little scratch test on the trunk or on the branches, and what you can do with your fingernail or a little sharp object, and just scrape a little bit and see if it's green underneath. That's always a good sign. If it's not green underneath, then you have something to worry about. But
and we did have, there was some dieback this year due to the weather.
Yeah. But I think in general, plants should be by now starting to push out some kind of leaves or fruit or something, flower or something.
Grapes are late this year too. Everything's late this year.
Yeah. I'm hoping we have a really nice, late, hot fall.
I have heard that La Nina is lessening its grip, and maybe we may be back to normal by June.
I heard the same thing. But June, that's a long ways away.
Well, June is when it rains.
That's right. Rose Festival time, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. So what's happening right now is not a lot to do, except unless you want to plant some more plants, which is certainly possible. And, of course, these plants we have here at KBOO would be great ones to put in the ground right now. Something I wanted to mention I give talks a lot on growing things, and I've sort of added to my talks some just basic tips about stuff. And one of the things when you were talking about doing tomatoes came to my mind. Some people, when they plant a potted plant, don't really understand how important it is to loosen up the roots that are inside that pot. In most cases, a plant that's been in a pot for a while is going to have a fairly compact root system that can be circling around in the pot. And if you just plop that in the ground, those roots don't really have a big incentive to go outside that. It takes a while for them to get into the surrounding soil. So, you know, I do with a potted gallon plant, for example. I'll put it on the ground if it's pretty dense and push it with the heel of my hand and loosen it up a little bit and then pull out roots until I get a good number that are heading out away from the pot. And then those will get then in touch with the soil really quickly and get started.
And this holds true with vegetables too.
Yep, I'm sure.
You get to tomatoes plant. Okay, do we have an answer to the garden stumper? Are we ready to take a phone call? Okay. Good morning. You're with the Dirtbag.
Hi. Hello.
Here on the air.
Okay.
Good morning.
Is it a strawberry?
It is a strawberry. Very good. Well done.
Yeah, well, not exactly the most hard question.
No.
But I did have a question, or I was hoping you could go into your whole theory of not disturbing the soil when you're planting.
Okay.
And, I enjoy the show.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
All right. So we still have star jasmine, olive,
pineapple,
and pineapple guava. Okay.
Yeah.
Although the phone rang, we don't know exactly what that means. But you're telling me that these olives have flowers, which means they'll have fruit this year.
Yeah, this is an amazing plant. This is so precocious. It, like, starts right off. And the interesting thing about the olive, I was going to talk a little bit about pollination, and there's so many interesting ways that plants pollinate themselves or get pollinated, not only from the different kinds of insects and methods that do it, but the type of flowers they have. And this olive is self-fertile, so it only needs one of itself to make fruit. but olives are wind-pollinated, which is sort of interesting. So if when you have an orchard of olives, you've got lots of pollen floating around and the wind is doing its job, or breeze or whatever. When you have just one, then what I've found is works really well is to take a little Q-tip or a little brush when these flowers open and move the pollen from flower to flower to kind of help get them set. Now, one of the things, if you've got kids or grandkids, they love doing that.
Ah.
And you can teach them how to make, even though it isn't really bee sound appropriate, you can still have them make bee sounds while they're moving their pollen around. And then the results are you'll have a whole tree full of olives that you can then process and eat.
Yeah, think about us here, too. We've no more olives. Olives are gone, but we still have the pineapple guava.
Yep, two of them.
Two, okay.
Right. And that's actually kind of a pretty special plant. It's native to the mountains of Brazil. This is not, I like to say, using my English skills, it's neither a pineapple nor a guava.
Mm-hmm.
So if people out there thinking this is a guava that's really a tropical plant, this is not. This is a hardy shrub, not a tree. I've been growing it for over 25 years. Beautiful plant in the yard. And being evergreen, it's just a neat, neat plant. And has these underneath the leaves is a silvery color, and the top is a really dark green. And these really
how big does it get?
Well, if you let it grow, my 25-year-old trees are they're probably 7 feet tall now, but
okay.
They're really easy to keep smaller than
that.
Yeah,
sure.
And people do them, and sometimes make them into a hedge. But they're not they're slow growing, very attractive, open sort of shrub.
Okay. Well, one of the go ahead.
Well, one other thing I was going to mention with our concerns about water, which, of course, this year maybe we don't have any, but the pineapple guava is probably one of the most drought-resistant plants that I've seen. I have plants I don't water, I mean, all summer.
So it might be a good candidate for a parking strip or someplace.
Absolutely. Yeah, a great spot for that. I mean, it would be a great spot for it. It's really amazing how tough they are.
But it takes sun.
They love sun.
Yeah,
and, sure. They would like to have probably half-day sun at least.
Well, parking strip could be the...
Yeah.
Could be the thing. Okay, $60 pledge for that there.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of fruit, one of the things that we'll probably want to, or I'll probably want to start doing before we are on the second Wednesday of June, and that would be to start bagging the apples to prevent worm damage. And this is a very simple technique. Just use a sandwich bag, cut a little hole in the bottom of the bag, just large enough to get it over your very small apple. Fingernail size, and you turn the bag upside down, of course, at that point. Slip the bottom of the bag over the apple. It closes around the stem of the apple, and the small apple will hold the bag on. And I staple the bottom of the bag. And, boy, it stays on until the end of August, and you take it off, and the fruit will color up, sweeten up, and you'll have a pretty nice darn worm-free apple, maybe 95-98% efficiency. Now, some folks with the Home Orchard Society will use called fruit socks now or something like that, nylons. And that works pretty well, but for some people, it works very well, but I've had better success with the bags, and they're compostable. Mm-hmm. I have some photos that I noticed a carrot growing in my yard that was a little weird, and pulled it up, and you know how sometimes, ducks or geese or something might swim through a plastic ring for, six pack. I guess they don't do that anymore. Yes, they do. Well, anyway, it gets constricted, their wildlife.
Yes, yes.
Well, this is what happened with one of those nylon baggies in my carrot. It had girdled it in the middle.
Oh,
it had grown up, yeah, because I had inadvertently gotten into the compost pile. And
you're saying the plastic bags are compostable?
No. It wasn't compostable.
Oh, okay.
Right. So yeah. It was there in the elements, and my carrot found it. We have just a few minutes left, and I'd like to follow up on the caller, the winner of the Garden Stumper, strawberries being the first fruit to ripen in Oregon. Jim has maybe an exception here.
Well, I just wanted to mention that there might be an interesting race between honeyberries and strawberries. That's a new fruit to our area, but it does ripen very, very early, and I haven't had a chance to have them side by side, which I'll have to do one of these days.
At the farmers' markets now, they grow strawberries under hoops, and they'll have them in May.
Yeah,
mid May they'll have strawberries.
That's kind of cheating.
Yeah, it is,
but it's good cheating.
it's like the honeybee not being native to North America, but
that's right.
It's a good
insight. We'll put up with it.
Yeah. Okay, just a few minutes here, following up on the question about the why I don't disturb the soil unless I absolutely need to. There's no reason that biological reason that plants need to have fluffy soil. That's just the nature of it. And nature goes to great lengths to create good structure of the soil. That is to say, how your soil molecule or particles are put together, sand, silt, clay. There are channels in there that are created by some insects that are burrowing and other organisms, some worms and some plant roots, and the bacteria and fungus and nematodes, protozoa, they're all down in there. This soil food web, they are eating each other, or some are eating each other. They're living, they're pooping, and they're making nutrients available for the plants, and that all happens in this, what is called pore space, this P-O-R-E, pore space, and you destroy that. You destroy the structure of the soil when you're rototilling, or even to some extent hand turning. That's not nearly as destructive as rototilling when you really pulverize that. And it's this, the nutrients that result from the eating and dying and the pooping and whatnot from all these organisms is now in a form that the plants can use. So that's on the soil, on the nutrient part of why I don't recommend tilling. But on a more maybe practical level, when you rototill, you'll also bring a whole new batch of weed seeds to the surface. And who needs that? They just need a split second of light in order to germinate, and when they get it, they do. I can't remember what weed it was, but Oregon State did an experiment some years ago where they plowed a field at night when it was dark, and then part of the field maybe when it was light, and they reduced their weed growth germination by, I think, 90% when they did it at night.
But didn't those seeds see the light in the day the next day?
Well, they don't all stay at the surface. When the seed is churned up and then falls down and gets covered up there. So, but that's a good point. I don't have firsthand knowledge of that. But.
One thing that I noticed when we do rototilling in our nursery to incorporate manure and stuff into the soil on a large scale, but you've got to be really careful not to do that before a rain. I mean, if you have rain threatening, don't get the rototiller out because you disturb that structure, that top surface of soil you rototilled won't drain.
Uh-huh.
The water will sit there and you'll have soupy mud until everything gets back together again and it gets those channels to take the water away.
Well, you mentioned a very important part of something that I didn't say in that you do it to incorporate organic matter. And gardeners may have to do that at the beginning of their plot. But after a while, and that might be 5 years, it might be 15 years, you can get by adding organic matter to the soil surface.
Yes.
And let the organisms bring that down in there. So that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Jim, for joining us again.
It's my pleasure. I hope those plants have found their new homes.
We know some of them certainly have.
Yes.
And we appreciate all of you who have called to claim those plants, to have pledged, and who listened to the Dirt Bag. We'll be back the second Wednesday of June at 11 o'clock. Carlos, thank you very much for filling in, and we'll be back. Thanks for listening.
Happy spring.
Indeed.